So yeah, you work from home, so you don't have to go in office. You're lucky. I have to commute. The building management today thought the best way to celebrate St. Patrick's Day was to bring a guy in to do smoothies. But
okay,
get this. So the smoothies were green, but they featured the traditional Irish ingredients of tropical fruits and green fruits, like green, like a sour apple, like a Granny Smith apple and stuff. It was pretty f***ed up. It was so bad.
What?
It was for St. Patrick's Day. I was like, okay, like...
There were free shamrock shakes at the Capitol yesterday. That's all I know.
That's a lot better than a tropical smoothie.
Yeah, that was much more festive. Welcome to episode number 94 of The Memory Jar. As always, we are here to remember the cards, the decks, the people, and the stories that make Magic the game we love. I'm David Prestwood, and with me, as always, is my co-host, Christian Wright. Christian, it's been a while, man. How have you been? How are you doing?
I've been doing all right, you know, just getting, you know, Magic. Hey, wait, sorry. I gotta go get that. I think someone's here with a package. This is weird.
It's like 11 p.m. Eastern time. What are you doing?
Dude, it's D.C., the FedEx people work very late.
So. Fair enough.
Okay, so I got this box, but it's weird because it's addressed to you, and it's wrapped in old boosters. I'm just going to open it just to make sure. Oh, no. It's just one booster. We got to open the memory jar.
But we haven't even introduced the episode yet.
David, you're going to... Gotta calm down. Don't do the rash thing. Just go to open the memory jar.
You're freaking me out, man. What's in the booster?
Don't let wizards win, David. Just crack open the memory jar. If you see what's in the booster, then wizards wins.
Come on, man. What's in the booster? What's in the booster? And scene. That's a reference to Seven, if anybody hasn't seen Seven. But you probably have by this point. All right, on this episode of The Memory Jar, we are talking about booster packs, or boosties, as we like to call them, the true cardboard crack of Magic the Gathering. With how many times Wizards has changed what is actually in a regular booster pack of Magic, we'll go over the history of what exactly you find when you crack a pack, and then some of the out there things that Wizards has tried for their distribution of cards. But before we do that, let's actually go ahead and crack open... All right, this time around, our card is Caramonix the Rat King. This is a rare from a recent set just last year, Phyrexia All Will Be One. It is one black for a 3/3 legendary creature, Phyrexian Rat. It has Toxic One. I would not have remembered this had Toxic One if I wasn't just reading the card right now. It says other rats you control have Toxic One. And then when Caramonix enters the battlefield, you look at the top 5 cards of your library. You may reveal any number of rat cards from among them and put the revealed cards into your hand. Put the rest on the bottom of your library in a random order. So this, I guess, is a rat commander.
Yeah, I mean, there's one of 3 possible legendary rats now that you can use as a rat commander. Caramonix is one if you want to go the poison route, probably the better of the 3 available. There's Ashcoat of the Shadow Swarm, which was a jumpstart card from 2 years ago, so it's a very recent jumpstart set. And lastly, the classic Marrow Gnar. Gnar? It's goner.
Marrow. It's marrow, like bone marrow. Like marrow gnar.
Okay, look, yeah. This is...
In, that one again. This is a tough one.
No. I'm keeping this in. This is the Pronunciation Hall of Fame. I just realized it. I'm just going to leave it as is. This one's a classic one. This one's from Betrayers of Kamigawa. Or Champions. Sorry, yeah. Champions of Kamigawa. It's a classic rat legend that makes more rats. All the rats.
And that is the rat thing, is making more rats. Well, marrow gnar is $30, man.
Ooh.
That is wild. Rats are a weird thing in Magic. There are Relentless Rats and then Rat Colony cards that have that text, you know, a deck can have any number of cards named this, which I guess you could just have your commander deck be a bunch of Swamps and Relentless Rats and then Caramonix as the commander. There's one of the Murderers at Karlov Manor, Slime Against Humanity. It's the same thing. It's an ooze payoff. That's pretty sweet. I really like when they do that. and ooze rat. They should have an ooze rat. We'll be on the lookout for that. But I like when they do that rule breaking text on a card. I have a real question for you. How do we feel about the fact that there's not actually a rat king in Magic? And by a rat king, I mean when a bunch of rats get their tails all tied together because they're on a big pile. When is that card coming?
I don't know, but I feel like they've had a zombie king and they've had a lot of goblin king or zombie master. Mm. I'm sorry. They've had goblin king, though. They've had a lot of different kings. I think the rats need their king. And I think it would be one of the grosser cards that they could possibly release. So I'm down. Let's get a star rat king as a nice throwback at like Modern Horizons 3 or something.
I want it to be green black. So it's an ooze rat. Like all the rats have gelatinized together. Gelatinous rats? Gelatinous rat?
Oh, you know what? Actually, what if we make it bug colored and you can make it a Simic rat king? Like the Simic created it. And it's like a mutant rat ooze. And then that way you can like clone rats and you can have rat clones. So you can have more effective rats in play. I like it. I'm feeling good.
So we actually do have a legendary rat in Sultai Colors. Nashi Moon's Legacy is from that weird Mom Aftermath set.
Oh, they did. I just forget about that. Yeah.
And that lets you, I think when it attacks, you exile like a legendary card or a rat card from your graveyard and copy it. They've definitely tried that. I don't think we have a green black one. We also, I guess in white black we have, what is the rat pilot?
Oh, Grease Fang. Yeah, it doesn't.
Grease Fang. Yeah, I'm like, this is a deck. I should know this information. Anyway, we're going down a rat hole right now, which is much worse than a rabbit hole. So we might as well get on to the show.
Yes. And I think that's also apropos because we were both recently saw each other in Chicago. So the rat random card button actually makes sense.
Are you saying that Chicago is a city full of rats?
No, it has the rat hole, like the rat that was in the cement. How do you not remember this?
No, I don't remember this. I could tell you all about Pizza Rat, but Chicago rat hole?
I'm going to pull this up. Yeah, it's a tourist attraction. It's like a random.
I have seen this. Yep.
Yeah.
No. Tell the listeners. This is important.
So if you don't remember what went viral about a month ago, the Chicago rat hole is a hole shaped like a rat in the sidewalk at West Roscoe Street in the Roscoe Village neighborhood of Chicago, Illinois. After existing for decades, it became a viral phenomenon on social media in January 2024, attracting tourists to the site. It's a little rat that fell in the cement and then ran away. And it's been immortalized forever. And the grimy. No, Chicago's not grimy. It's just wants to be grimy.
They should fill the hole with cheese and then put a bunch of pizza sauce on it and then cover that with Malort. A real Chicago treat.
Oh, yeah. That actually tastes better than their pizza. Ooh, I'm kidding.
Oh, ooh. Wait, I thought you liked Chicago deep dish pizza.
Actually, I have not had authentic Chicago deep dish pizza. Yeah. If we were in Chicago,
I'm not a big fan of it. I think it's tomato soup in a bread bowl, which actually I would rather have than Chicago deep dish pizza. So get out of here, Chicago, with your terrible fake pizza. I'm out on that.
Natalie just came and gave me a very angry look that I've not had Chicago pizza. And so she's very angry at me right now.
All right. We're going to make it happen at some point.
Yeah. Wait. I'm going to tell her what you said. Dave says Chicago pizza is tomato soup in a bread bowl. She says false. And she asks, where's Minneapolis pizza?
Minneapolis pizza is very thin crust. It cut into squares.
That's just Detroit pizza.
No. Detroit pizza's thicker. Detroit pizza's cooked in a pan, so it has higher sides. Ours are like, it's like saltine level thickness cut into squares.
Oh, so it's Lido's. It's basically Lido's pizza.
Yeah, Lido's is a very Minnesota style pizza for sure.
Minnesota is a very Lido style pizza for sure.
Rot in hell. Rot in hell.
Anyway, on to the main show.
All right. So Magic is now, what, 30 years old? And there have been a few immutable characteristics of the game, I think, through that entire history. So the card back is one. Every legal playable card shares the same card back, I guess, unless they're double-sided cards, but we can ignore that. The five colors is another. Or only five colors. They added colorless, still five colors. But I think one of those things is the booster pack. Cards coming in booster packs being the primary method of collecting new cards has been where we've been for a very long time. And there have been some changes to that with Commander decks and other products, but for the vast majority of cards printed every year, they all come from the same source, this pack of some number of cards, randomized, sealed in some kind of plasticky foil wrapper. It is just the boosty.
Yeah, and there's nothing more identifiable to Magic and trading cards in general than the booster pack. The sight of people tearing open a pack and going over its contents is a universal symbol of degenerates into playing card games. The excitement of what could be paired with the deflation of the contents of the pack is an action recognizable across every culture and country in the world. There's a lot of thought into how a booster pack is presented, what has to be written on the pack itself, and the art of presenting them and selling them to people, that you could fill this entire subject with a dissertation. It's like a fantastic, fascinating psychology lesson, right?
Yeah, and it's changed. The texture of the booster packs has changed. The materials have changed. Where they're printed in the world has changed. They're originally all Belgium, and now they're mostly the US and Japan, but there are a couple of other places. But the booster pack still is the booster pack. The difference is how cards are put into a booster pack, what is actually in the booster pack, has been really inconsistent. Now, Wizards did settle on a distribution that stayed largely unchanged for more than 20 years, but recently we've seen different types of booster packs and different contents within those boosters. So what I want to talk about today is kind of how those boosters started, what has changed through Magic's history, and what would we would like to do if we were the CEO of Hasbro, or maybe just the CEO of Wizards of the Coast, since Hasbro would just be like, give us your money, and choke the life out of us.
Capitalism. Yeah, so yeah. Let's start with like the distribution that I think everyone has known and loved. We'll call it the standard distribution. It's one rare mythic, mm-hmm. three uncommons, mm-hmm. 10 commons, I don't have enough hands for that, and then one basic land and one token or add card.
Yep.
So that's 15 playable cards, one of which is a basic land. I'll stop there. We'll add some more detail later. Is that sound about right?
Yeah. Yep, that is the standard distribution. So I think before we get into the details, I want to propose here that we just talk about mainline boosters. So that kind of standard distribution. Let's skip like dual decks and jumpstart and collector boosters and all of those things that aren't really meant to draft with a couple exceptions. But I think we want to talk about the mainline product. Deal?
Oh, yeah. I agree with that. So we have the modern baseline then, right? The standard distribution. Yep. But let's go back to the beginning. Alpha, Beta, Unlimited. How did the first players acquire new cards in 1993 and 1994?
Well, in the beginning, there were booster packs and there were starter decks. So nerds like me walking into their local comic shop could either buy 15-card boosties or a 60-card starter deck. And starter decks were interesting because they had all the lands that were important mm-hmm. to cast your spells, but the number of lands wasn't guaranteed. The only guarantee was the starter deck had... It's different than the standard distribution because it was more cards, two rares, 13 uncommons, and 45 commons. Booster packs then had one rare, three uncommons, and 11 commons. This was before you got a basic land in every pack. They were just kind of seeded in amongst the commons for the most part. And I'll just note here, although this isn't really the point, there were no mythics until Shards of Alara, which was printed 15 years after Alpha. And there were no tokens either. So those things all came a little later.
Yeah, it's funny because... players still needed lands, so it's kind of super diabolical of Wizards that the lands could appear in all three rarity slots. Like, that's how they designed it as this, you know, gotcha. So there was one quote-unquote rare island, which was one island on the rare sheet in Alpha Beta Unlimited, and all of the lands could replace an uncommon and a common. So you could open a booster pack, and instead of a Black Lotus or a Shivan Dragon, it could be an island. Two lands in the uncommon slots, and then a bunch of lands is common. So you opened your own $8, $9 land pack in 1993, essentially. This was highway robbery and meant you absolutely had to open another booster since you got incredibly unlucky.
Yeah, I think that they finally fixed that and revised. So no basic land problem in the rare slot. They were in the commons and uncommons. And then once they started doing tournament packs... there were just lands as their own thing in there. So you would have a guaranteed number of rares, commons, uncommons, but the lands would be separate. And then finally in fourth edition, which was revised, is also known as third edition. So it was the next kind of mainline set. They stopped putting basic lands in the booster packs altogether. You could get them through the tournament packs.
Yes. And it's interesting because they cut one uncommon for one more rare in tournament decks partway through the revised print run. So earlier print runs had the two rare 13 uncommon plus 45 uncommon distribution. And then for whatever reason, they switched it, which I'd actually love to know the reason.
All I know is my first starter deck had two rares, Mahamari Jin and Volcanic Island. I'm sure that you can guess that I was really excited about the 5/6 flyer. And I was like, oh, this land is also cool. But at least I hung on to it. That's what matters.
What's actually super interesting is that they made tournament packs 75 cards, starting in Urza's Saga for seal tournaments, and that slowly morphed into just 6 booster packs. Because back in the day, if I remember correctly, you could only play with the lands you opened in the sealed in the tournament pack for a sealed tournament. So there's a lot of really bad sealed decks because you only could play up to like 8 basics of one color, basically. So it's fascinating.
Lucky to have the Devil's Mana base. Like, either you got cards you want to play, but you don't have the right lands to play them.
Right.
And so, I mean, all of this is because limited was not a thing at the beginning of Magic. So there was no concept of packs that had color balance or, you know, even playable creatures. And none of that really existed. People just cracked packs to get cards. And that was basically it.
Yeah, I think it was. There's a really famous Rich Hagon article, or not, I don't know if it's an article, but he was talking about what to do with boosters. And he said that he remembered opening his first booster box, which was Stronghold. And he went and tore through all of the packs and then just got disappointed because that was it. And he's like, what do I do with these? And I almost want to be like, Rich, no one knew what to do with them. Limited was just introduced.
Yeah.
So who knows?
Where did we go with boosters from there? We have that kind of close to the standard distribution, revised. What do we do with expansions?
So it's funny because immediately after Alpha Beta Unlimited, the very first sets in Magic history, Wizards mixed it up for the first expansions. So we have Arabian Nights and Antiquities, and they decided, you know what? This 15-card booster pack is nonsense. We're going to sell them in 8-card booster packs. And they contain 2 uncommons and 6 commons. So where are the rares?
The answer to that is some uncommons were more uncommon than others. So uncut sheets back then were the same as they are now, 121 cards, 11 rows by 11 rows, and each card had multiple printings on a sheet. So, for example, what we think of as a rare in Arabian Nights had 2 copies on that uncommon sheet. So their rarity was actually an uncommon 2 or a U2. Cards that were U3 were printed one more time on the sheet, were thus more common than the U2s, and those are considered the actual uncommons. And also, without going way too into it, commons had different rarities in that set. It's very, very confusing.
If I remember correctly, there's like one common in Arabian Nights. It's like common 8, which is wild, but I think it's desert. Desert might have been common 8.
You are correct that the desert was the outlier there. So we had these boosters, which were conveniently cheaper because they had fewer cards in them. And this same formula was used for the Dark Fallen Empires and Homelands. Arabian Nights was the only set that didn't have U1 cards. That means its rares appeared on the uncommon sheet more than once, so its rares are less rare than future rares. The other set rares were all U1s. And so, that's right, if you know your set order, that means, yes, they did do it differently for Legends, because Legends came in 15-card packs. So it went Arabian Nights, Antiquities, 8-card packs. Legends, 15, then immediately back to 8 for the Dark. And yes, also Ice Age, which came out between Fallen Empires and Homelands, was also in the same 15-card packs, 1 rare, 3 uncommons, and 11 commons with no basic lands. So it was like big expansion, small expansion, big expansion, small expansion. Very confusing.
And as we talked about in a throwback, I think it was our throwback to 1996, they'd also didn't have a set schedule for sets. It was like 6 months between sets for like Homelands and Ice Age or something. I will say, it's funny, true story, and I experienced this firsthand. Up until 2012, you could walk into a local game store, and if you ask kindly, they would sell you Fallen Empires or Homeland packs for maybe $1, or give them to you for free, because the cards in them weren't worth more than the paper they were printed on. This is absolutely true. For the longest time, Didgeridoo was the most expensive card in Homelands, and it was still like $2 for a very long time.
Well, you can currently buy your cheapest box of Fallen Empires on TCG Player for $560 plus shipping. Not including shipping on that is kind of a beat. We've got the 15-card packs, we've got the 8-card packs, so we're set, right? No. Wizards was looking to try something new, and so in July of 1995, they released Chronicles. This was a new set white bordered, all reprints that had 12 card packs. So these are one rare, three uncommons, and eight commons. They then tried this in a mainline set in June 1996 with Alliances, which came out after the eight card packs for Homelands. So we're really bouncing off the walls now.
Yeah, this was thankfully a very brief experiment.
It certainly was. And so in October of that same year, in 96, Mirage was released, and now we're back to 15 cards. Again, a rare, three uncommons, 11 commons with no basics. And this was the first set designed to be drafted. This is where we really enter the modern era of packs. Let's just do a quick recap. Alpha Beta Unlimited, 15 cards. Then Arabian Nights and Antiquities, 8 cards. Revised and Legends, 15 cards. Then The Dark and Fallen Empires, 8 cards. Then 4th Edition and Ice Age, 15 cards. Chronicles, 12 cards. What are we doing? Homelands, 8 cards. Alliance is back to 12. And then Mirage, 15. So we're now caught up to October of 1996.
It sounds like going from Mirage forward, we settled into a regular draft booster, right? So end of show? Shortest show we've ever put together?
Not so fast, my friend. We may have settled in at 15-card booster packs almost 30 years ago, but there were a lot of changes to collation, and I want to talk about a couple examples. So the easiest one of those is foil cards. And I know that you know better than I do when foil started and how they appeared in packs.
Yeah, so they started in Urza's Legacy, which I remember the announcement for it. It was super exciting. And for years, a foil would replace a card of the appropriate rarity. So if you got a rare foil card, that meant it replaced the rare, normal rare in the pack. This happened for literally almost a decade. And then in Time Spiral, they changed it to the current method so that a foil always replaced a common. So no field bads. You can actually start opening two rares in your packs.
And we love to do so. We'll talk more about opening multiple rares down the road here. So that's where they would appear in packs. I want to talk a little bit about how often they would appear. So for the first 2.5 years of foils, from Urza's Legacy to Odyssey, 1 out of every 100 cards was a foil. That's pretty rare. That's slightly better than 1 in every 7 packs. So you're not going to see them very often. Then with Torment, the ratio went down to 1 in every 70 cards. So now you're talking about a little bit better than 1 in every 5 packs. And then for some reason, the ratio bounced back and forth between 1 in every 70 to 1 in every 56 cards. And it went back and forth between those two things for about 9 years. Then in Conflux, the ratio settled in at 1 in every 67 cards. That's 1 in 4.5 packs. And it stayed there all the way until Modern Horizons. So we're talking about 10 years. So it was 1 in every 67 until Core Set 2020, when it settled at what has been the recent ratio, 1 in every 45 cards, which is just a very clean 1 in exactly every 3 packs. And this is not counting, of course, special sets, non-standard sets, where each pack contains a guaranteed foil. The Modern Master sets, for example, or some of the remastered sets have always had a specific foil slot.
Yeah, in fact, I think I'd have to double check, but I still think Shards of Alara, Conflux, and Alara Reborn foils are still super cheap because they used to sell 15-card all-foil packs of random cards of those three sets, which no one bought because why would you?
I do remember those packs existing when I came back to the game. You know, people were selling them, and I was like, 15 foils, that seems surprisingly cheap. Well, it's because they were very bad.
Yes.
I think it's also here worth mentioning, in addition to foils, bonus sheets, because those changed the makeup of packs as well. And the first bonus sheet was one of your favorites. That was in Time Spiral.
In Time Spiral, they added the Time Shifted sheet. So these were cards that had been previously printed in Magic's history, and there's at least one card from every set previously printed before Time Spiral. It was a new slot that guaranteed that one card from that sheet, cards that were not otherwise in the set, were in every pack. Wizards has used this technology a few more times since then for sets like Strixhaven, Brothers War, March of the Machine, and Wilds of Eldraine, put cards in packs that were outside of standard legality, but provide an opportunity to print old cards and use them in the draft environment.
Yeah, they also used this technology in Innistrad for double-sided cards before they figured out how to update collation technology to insert cards within their rarities. So in original Innistrad, you'd get a double-sided card in every pack. In future Innistrad sets, you would have a double-sided card in every pack, but they would be within their rarity slot. And then War of the Spark used the same technology. There was a Planeswalker in every pack, also within their rarity slot, because they appeared at uncommon as well as at rare. So this was an interesting way to change up the makeup of a booster. Why are we talking about all of this stuff? Because boosters have changed, and we're talking about play boosters. These are the new way that we're drafting, playing sealed, and cracking packs. for a while now, specifically since Zendikar Rising in September 2020 through, I guess, Lost Caverns of Ixalan at the end of 2023 was the last one, the mainstream booster market was split in half. Draft boosters existed for playing, and they created something called set boosters for opening. Set boosters had guaranteed foils. They had some flex slots so you could end up with additional rares. They were only 12 cards a pack, but they were at a higher price point. These were very popular with players who just wanted to acquire cards. And without getting too deep into product distribution, this created a lot of problems for local game stores who needed draft boosters for people to play with, but set boosters to sell. And so it was a challenge for them to figure out what the allocations were. So Wizards came up with play boosters. They have all of the variety and potential payout of set boosters, but they are draftable.
So this started in February 2024 with Murders at Karloff Manor. So you remember the standard distribution, that's 10 commons, 3 uncommons, and 1 rare mythic, and 1 land in a booster. That's what we're used to. Well, now it's chaos. It's 6 to 9 commons, 3 to 6 uncommons, 1 to 4 rare / mythic rares, and a land could be in your booster. And the higher number of the higher rarity cards means commons are the ones that get taken out first. So they have to design more uncommons because there's
fewer. I don't think that's necessarily true.
Oh.
Because there's just flex slots.
Oh, there's flex slots. Right.
So we could talk about that because I think, we do talk about this.
I was under the impression when I first read the article that commons were getting the shaft in general, so that you could have a 9 common booster, but that was fairly rare, that you'd more often find stuff with more uncommons and even rares.
Yeah, I think that's the case. So we've got those numbers, and the total number of those cards is going to be 14, not 15. So let me just talk a little bit about how it works. So you're guaranteed in a pack 6 commons, 3 uncommons, 1 rare or mythic rare, and 1 basic or common land guaranteed in each pack. So that's 11 cards. There's one slot that is filled with either a common, and that's 87.5% of the time. So most of the time you'll get 7 commons. Or it could be a card from the list, which is something that was in set boosters. It's a curated selection of cards from Magic history that are usually theoretically in some way thematically tied to the set. And those cards can be any rarity. It's just whatever they are in the list. For Murders at Karloff Manor, it's a curated list of 40 cards. In the past, it's been literally hundreds of cards. So that's one slot. Another slot is a non-foil wild card. That's very simply any card from the set at any rarity. So, you know, probably a common, could be something else. And then there's one slot that is a guaranteed foil, and this is also a wild card. So again, any card from the set at any rarity. So I think the expectation is you'll get 8 to 9 commons, you'll get 3 to 4 uncommons, and you'll get 1 to 2 rares. I think it's about 1.4 rares or mythics per booster is how it works out. So it's higher than it was because previously you could get a rare and a foil rare. And that's assuming there are no bonus sheets or anything else. So again, the short version is we're trading away one playable card because we're now down to 14 card packs for cards potentially at higher rarities and a guaranteed foil. And the upshot of that is we're paying a higher price for these boosters than we did for draft boosters. I think most people who draft in paper at their LGS will notice that drafts are maybe $5 more expensive than they used to be. Hopefully it's not, it's not more than that. It's a big change. And it's an unprecedented change. We've been here for a long time. So I think the question is, what do we think about this?
I've played with them for a bit. And what is weird for me is I have the muscle memory of that standard distribution. So if I see a missing uncommon or the rare is missing, then I know generally what was taken. And it's like I can strategically think about what the person to my right had picked in a booster. But now that's kind of thrown out the window because you could have 2 rares or you could have a bunch of uncommons. And so it's, you're taking a step back where you don't really have to think so much about what people are taking, because not only can you not predict with certainty what rarity of a card was taken, you also can't predict what color, because the packs aren't color balanced anymore too. So it's kind of dialed drafting back a bit, where you're just kind of taking really good cards that are left and not really worrying about what signals you're sending or what you're trying to force your opponent to get into, because it's kind of a lot more random.
Yeah, that has been a big change for me. Previously, you look at a pack, you know, and traditionally, you're going to be guaranteed at least one common of each color. So if you get past a pack, the rare's still in it. You say, oh, a white common is missing. I can maybe figure out what card they took. You know, there's a Oblivion Ring or something in the pack. That must be what they took. You just can't do that anymore. And so it's about figuring out what's open. You just have to do it in a slightly different way. And that is really tricky. I've been past pack one, pick two, unpassable cards because there must have been two unpassable cards in the pack. It's as simple as that. And that's happened way more often than it ever has before. On a whole, I think it's been good so far. I have enjoyed it. I have enjoyed the increased number of rares, not because they're powerful, but because there are some kind of niche build around rares that you're just going to see more often. And I think there are niche build around uncommons that maybe you see more often. So I've enjoyed that. I will say I've done most of my drafting on Arena, and the play boosters are a little weird because the play boosters are using the same collation as in paper, which means they're using a foil slot, but there are no foils on Arena. And so sometimes on Arena, you open a pack and then there are sitting two of the same card. And that wouldn't seem weird if it was like MTGO where one was foil, but they just look exactly the same. They're just sitting next to each other in the pack. It's very weird. It's just something that we have to get used to. I mean, that's happened to me in paper before. I remember in a Born of the Gods draft, when I had recently come back to the game, I opened a pack with two Fall of the Hammer in it. I'm like, if I get one, do I just get to take both? And they were like, shut up and keep drafting. So no, you don't is the answer. It's not something we're used to there.
How do you feel about it? Because you did the pre-release and I did not get to do the pre-release. Yes. How'd you feel about the play boosters in the pre-release?
I think there were certainly a lot more rares. I've been fortunate at recent pre-releases to open, I think, an absurd number of playable rares. I think this time I had 11. Five of them were two colored lands that I could play in my deck. And I believe that, and I'll have to look into this, but I believe I read that in packs where you get a second rare slightly more often, there'll be a land. So you're not getting like two full powered rares necessarily. And it mitigates the feel bad of getting a rare land in a pack when you're drafting, because generally those aren't as good. Although the Surveil lands in Murders at Carlov Manor are pretty nice. So I didn't mind it. I didn't think everything seemed more overpowered. But then, you know, I did one pre-release. It's hard to tell.
It'll be interesting to see with Outlaws at Thunder Junction, which,
yes,
now that I say it more often, this might be the second worst title or third worst title I've ever had to say for a Magic set.
Pause there. Top three worst names of Magic sets. Go.
Outlaws at Thunder Junction. Of okay. Thunder Junction?
I believe it is Outlaws of Thunder Junction, yes.
It's still bad. Two is, I think it's Journey into Nyx.
Hmm.
Just okay. Or Born of the Gods. But Saviors of Kamigawa is also a dumb one. I don't know. But it's Mercadian Masks. That is still, without question, the stupidest title for a card set. Yeah. Wait, what about you?
My third worst one is Murders at Carlov Manor, because I keep thinking it's Markov Manor, because there are way more Markov cards than there are Karlov cards when you think about what's going on in Ravnica. My second worst is Outlaws of Thunder Junction. I think that's just a weird mouthful. And my worst is Commander Legends Battle for Baldur's Gate.
It's too many
words, and I always think it's Battle of Baldur's Gate, but I think it's Battle for Baldur's Gate. I actually don't know which one is right, and I'm not going to look, and you can't make me.
Yeah, that's stupid as hell. You're absolutely right. I always forget about that. Conspiracy 2, was it to Take the Crown? Was that the full title, or was it just Conspiracy 2?
I think it was Conspiracy Take the Crown Electric Boogaloo, but don't quote me on that.
Oh, that's also bad now that I think about it. Maybe we just have to do a set. We have to do an episode all about set names.
We'll just rank all of the set names. Anytime there's an of or a for, I always think it's the other one. So this sounds like a me problem, but at least we're not doing core set 2020 in the year 2019 anymore.
The only good multi-word title they've had is Return to Ravnica, because it's two R's. It's the assonance of Return to Ravnica. Like, it's very similar. It rolls off the tongue. And we just wanted to go back to Ravnica. So it was like, cool. Like, this is literally what we're doing here. Let's go. You don't have to think about who's betraying Kamigawa? Who's the champion of Kamigawa? I'm confused about all this. It's just, no.
I'll give you $100 if you can tell me right now what the subtitle of Strixhaven is. Strixhaven School is not the name of the set. Oh, no! All right, I owe you.
You don't owe me anything, because I was going to say that as a bad one, because that actually might be and should be in the top three, because that's been stuck in my brain. It's so stupid. It should just be Strixhaven, but no, it's...
Okay, well, then tell me this. What was the subtitle for Kaldheim?
There was none.
Oh, man, you're so good at this. I should know. I should know better than to BS a BSer, as they say.
Yeah.
So you were in the middle of a thought on Outlaws of Thunder Junction and what the boosters are going to be like, and I completely derailed you talking about set names. So let's jump back for a sec.
I derailed myself. The thing that'll be interesting is they have all those random wanted cards that really don't look like Magic cards. And so I think that'll be a very interesting test for how this distribution goes, in the sense that, like, if you're a new player, right? So Murza Call of Manor also had cards that really didn't look like Magic cards, those typewritten ones. But at least, like, if you squinted, they sort of had the same frame. These wanted cards don't. And so it's going to be really interesting if you're a new player to be like, I open this card that looks like a wanted poster. Can I play it? And there's going to be a lot of them. So...
Well, and so the wanted cards are actually just showcase cards. Those are going to be regular cards. The interesting thing for me about Outlaws of Thunder Junction is it's following generally this new play booster formula, but there is a bonus sheet that is different than the wanted posters. That is, I think it's called Breaking News, and they look like newspapers.
So that's what I was thinking of. That's what I was thinking of.
Because the wanted poster ones also exist.
Yeah, but the Breaking News ones, they look a little similar. I couldn't.
It's a Western font, you know, stuff like that. And there's a couple different versions of them. There's a newspaper looking one and a regular one. We're going to learn a lot more about this. But anyway, I think doing a play booster with a bonus sheet, we'll have to see how that affects Coalition generally. I don't want to leave this yet. I want to talk just a little bit about Mark Rosewater's Nuts and Bolts article. He does one of these every year. And this time he went extremely, extremely deep on the contents of play boosters, not just like how many commons there are, but on the design of a set to be featured in play boosters. Like, here are what the white commons will represent and the blue uncommons. And it's way too much detail to go into here. So I'll put the link in the show notes, but I want to share a couple of kind of overarching thoughts. One is they're reducing the number of one mana creatures in generally. And I think the hope there is to slow down formats a little bit, because even Murders at Karlov Manor, which is ostensibly a morph set and should be slow, is a pretty aggressive format. Second is they've reduced the total number of commons, like we talked about earlier, since there will be fewer in packs, and they've increased the total number of uncommons that they're printing. So the end result should be about the same distribution you will see in old draft boosters. You'll still be able to get multiples of commons. You still will see the uncommons kind of rarely. There's just more of them because you could get more uncommons in packs. And the other thing I thought was interesting is they're basically promising us two full multicolored uncommon cycles in every set, and they can deviate from this occasionally, but you know that I have long been a fan of the signpost uncommon cycle, and it sounds like we're going to get a signpost uncommon cycle and then something else that's an uncommon multicolored cycle that ties into the themes in the same way and is a payoff for being in that color pair, and that is really exciting to me.
It is really exciting. I do like the idea behind it. We'll have to see, again, how it comes turns out in execution is different. But as much as I didn't like the name of the set or the theme of Murders at Karlov Manor, draft-wise, it's been really fun.
Yeah.
Maybe they finally cracked kind of the mystery of having a very interesting, you know, not completely solved draft format finally. The other thing I thought was really interesting in the article is they're adding more colored pips to rares and mythics in general to make them less splashable, which I think is a fantastic idea.
Yeah, that is a really interesting change. I personally like splashing. I like the ability to play multiple colors. And if you're going to get more rares, I don't really see a problem with splashing them. So maybe that's not a change for me. But yeah, that will have probably a fascinating effect on Sealed, where you're more likely to just play your most powerful cards. And so maybe you'll have to end up with more streamlined decks, or, you know, there'll be some fixing available. But it does sound like they want to have some colorless fixing or something to tie the set together, like Prophetic Prism type card, something like that in every set. And we've already seen them designing for Best of One on Arena, where your cards all do multiple things. And I think this is an extension of that, where now they're designing for there aren't as many slots at common. So we're going to design those cards in a way where there can't really be stinkers. Everything is going to have to be a little more playable, and you should end up with more playable cards. But honestly, cutting one card out of every pack just means instead of ending up with 42 cards and three basics at the end of every draft, you're going to have 39 cards and three basics. And so if you want to make playables, you do have to have your cards be actually playable. TBD on that, but I agree with you. I think we're in a good place, and I'm going to trust them to figure this out.
Yeah. You know, they put some math into it, so they're thinking about it, hopefully.
Oh, math. That's our show today. But before we go, I got to say, you know, I just mentioned this 14-card pack thing. Rest in peace, Pygao. Pygao is more like, how could you, wizards? That joke is brought to you by Moxtopper, the official life tracking app of the Memory Jar. And by that, I mean, I stole it from our friend Jared, creator of Moxtopper and degenerate commander combo player.
You know, we really buried the lead. That was the first thing I thought of when they announced play boosters. I was so mad. I was like, can't Pygao. Like, this is the worst change.
I think the answer might be, if you want a Pygao, a couple answers. Three packs of four cards each, and then you burn a card and you burn the land. Like, is that the solution?
I think so. So we should tell listeners, too, if you haven't heard of it yet. Pygao is you open a traditional regular distribution booster pack, made five piles of three cards, and then you would pick it up, those three cards, and you'd play your opponent, who also had opened a booster in the same thing, and then you go best of five. You have five life and unlimited mana.
You're playing a bunch of mini games, and I feel like it wouldn't be the same with three mini games.
No.
We're missing out. I'm hoping we can get this 15th card back. I'm going to exert all of the non-existent pressure I have on Wizards of the Coast to just give us any aforementioned stinker. I think the real answer is that you have to play Pygao Cube. And yes. I have a box of just bulk that I put in the worst possible sleeves I could find that my local game store was throwing away. And that's my little Pygao Cube. I just saw that our friends at System Magic, that's Greg Michael and Andrew Ellenbogen, both of whom who have appeared in the podcast in some form, they have built a Pygao Cube that they actually legitimately curated. And I will put a link to that in the show notes as well, because that seems like a blast.
Yes. And listeners, it's really worth reading how they built it and curated it, because they really did put a lot of thought. Like, they took out some of the feel bad cards in Pygao, aka the lava axes. They have some really interesting cards they put in that forces you to actually make interesting piles and not kind of automatically have three good piles, a mediocre pile, and the crap pile. So definitely read it. It's worth the read. It's like 2 minutes, but it's enlightening.
Yep. Those guys are great in general. Their stream on Twitch is highly recommended. I'll put a link in there as well. You know, good guys, extremely good Magic players. That's pretty much it. We'll have a lot more to say about our time at MagicCon Chicago. And I'll talk about Peasant Commander and all kinds of other stuff, including maybe why we have been so busy and have not podcasted in a while. But we can save all of that for a future episode. In the meantime, I want to thank everyone for joining us today. You can find us on Twitter at our handle at MemoryJarMTG. We would love your feedback, and please tell us what cards you want to remember.
Again, special thanks to Chris Yates for the logo. We greatly appreciate it. You can find Chris on Twitter at CMYCompany. That's company with a K, but I don't even know if he tweets anymore, but it's still there.
Well, I know he's there. He's there. So that's still where you can find him.
Yes. And until next time, crack a booster. Tell us all about it. We look forward to playing with you soon.